to Regulated and Relational, the bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. Today, Julie and Ginger are talking about the four irreducible needs, as outlined in Dr. Gabor Mate's book, The Myth of Normal. Let's tune in to their chat.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Regulated and Relational, our podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Julie Beam.
And I'm Ginger Healy.
And we're so excited to share with you from both our personal experiences and our professional knowledge what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma.
So last summer, Julie and I both read The Myth of Normal, a new book by Dr. Gabor Mate. It's a very detailed book, and it covers how our culture does not yet understand how deeply the impacts of trauma have contributed to many of society's problems. And we both just loved it. But we found that there was so much pertinent information in the book that we just decided we've got to do a podcast on it, and probably two or three, right? Mm-hmm. But we wanted to definitely start with talking out about, well, what happened was it just sparked so many thoughts, and we wanted to be able to encourage our listeners to read or listen to the book as well. But we also know it's heavy and you may not have time to dive deep into it like we did. And so we wanted to kind of give you some bite-sized information that hopefully will be really impactful in your life. So this particular episode, we wanted to lean heavily into the human development pieces in Dr. Mate's book, especially foundational attachment and the challenges of parenting in this culture. And maybe it's just me who needs this information, but
no, I ring so many bells for me. Yeah.
I agree. And you and I are both at different stages in parenting. And so that says a lot too. This episode, we're talking specifically pulling information from chapter 9. And that's where Dr. Mate addresses the childhood years as the formative years and tells us that the individual and collective stakes are far higher than we can even imagine. Mm-hmm. So chapter 9, it pulls out these four irreducible needs that all children have. And so I just think that it's worth reflecting on these four needs for all the children that you and I and all of our listeners come in contact with, yes, whether we're a parent, whether we're a teacher, whatever role we have, it is applicable. So this chapter, it kind of starts out, it begins with the way our brains develop, talking about that feelings come before thoughts. So developmentally, we experience our emotions before we have the ability to process those emotions through our thinking brains, and especially before we have language to express the emotions. And so because of that, what we experience as an infant then molds our behavior and molds our emotional pattern, our unconscious beliefs, learning styles, relational dynamics, and the ability to handle stress and regulate ourselves. So that's huge.
Neither one of us was surprised to read that sentence from him, because we're like, wait, this is what ATN knows and believes at our core, right?
Yeah. But, you know, sharing that and putting that into context really helps. And so I want to begin with a quote from Dr. Mate. He says, "What he feels before he thinks is a powerful determinant of what kind of things he thinks when thought becomes possible." So just sit with that, and then I think it'll all kind of come together.
Yeah, so true. So, you know, the Harvard Center for the Developing Child is one of our favorite resources because they have so much information about early childhood development. And they talk about the architecture of the brain that is constructed through an ongoing process that begins before birth, continues all the way into adulthood, and establishes a foundation that is either sturdy or fragile And that foundation is for all the health, learning, and behavior that follows. So just like the quote from Dr. Mate about what you think when thinking becomes possible has been built on that foundation of what happened before, right? The interactions of your genes and your experiences shape this circuitry in the developing brain, and it's critically influenced by the responsiveness, the mutual responsiveness, that attachment, you know, that interaction, right, between the adults and the children, especially that first caregiver in those early childhood years. So things that happened to us when we were young in our youth really do matter. Early development in our childhood, especially our infant and toddlerhood, really matter. If emotion is the ground, is the foundation of cognition, we're going geology here, then relationship is the tectonic plates that shape that ground. So if you're thinking about a geological form or the geology of the country and where our tectonic plates are and where we're most likely to have earthquakes because they rub together, that's the relationships, right? And if you've got good relationships, you're not going to have as many earthquakes, is what I think he's saying there, right?
Yeah, that's how I interpreted it. And I thought it was a really visual, you know, great metaphor.
Yeah. And so he then, in this chapter, dives way deep into attachment theory, which, you know, I just geeked out on because it is something I think is so important. And Dr. Mate points out that in order to have your sense of security, a trust in the world, inner relationships with others, and connections to your own authentic emotions, you must have the availability of an attuned, non-stressed, emotionally reliable caregiver. It's a must, right? The more stressed and distracted that your caregiver is, the more those tectonic plates are going to crash, right? And the shakier your emotional architecture of your developing brain is going to be as a child. It's true.
Yeah, it's true. And it's also kind of heavy or weighty if you're a parent. And so that's why I just want to take a moment here to pause and loudly state that it's just important to understand that nothing in the science and nothing that we advocate for at ATN has to do with shaming parents. We would never do that. We don't believe in that. We have talked about that before, but I think sometimes we start to hear these things and it can creep up on.
Yeah, it evokes a shame. Yeah. You know, you're starting to feel it. Oh, I screwed up, you know. Well,
yeah. My kids will tell you I did.
Guess what? We all did. There's no perfect parent. There's good enough parenting.
And we can't talk about it enough. And so that's why I wanted to bring it up here. In fact, Dr. Mate makes it clear that, first of all, parent blaming, it's just cruel. And he also says it's unfair, which he's right about, and that it's nonsensical. Like, it doesn't even, you know, serve a purpose.
Right.
And here's why. And just as Julie said, every single one of us are human. Every single one of us has a nervous system that reacts to the environment around us. You know, we have genetics that have been passed on to us. And that can sometimes make us more or less sensitive to those inputs that we receive. So we have our own early beginnings, and some of us had our needs met and some of us didn't. And we are all continually working through that in this journey. So
exactly. The other point we want to make is that along with you, our listeners, we're all in this together, right? Because this isn't just about one parent not doing the right thing or multiple one parents individually. It's about us all together as a society, that we need to take this neuroscience that is so clear, that this early beginning is so important, and understand what our children need, and then change our society to help us do that, right? Totally change the narrative and place the emphasis on supporting children. And in order to support the children, you have to support the parents of those children, right? So that they can parent with fewer stressors, and they can parent in a more resilient way, and they can understand the importance of that and have the resources to do that, right? I mean, that to me is where the emphasis needs to be.
Absolutely. And you'll hear us say over and over again, community care. But we're just not there yet. In fact, we often fall into parent blaming when there are problems with building healthy relationships or any problems with children's behavioral, social, or emotional reactions. I see it all the time. It's quick and it's easy to do in today's society, especially as people hide behind things in social media. They feel brave enough to shame. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've heard professionals that work with children say, well, if the parents would just, fill in the blank. But really, the truth is that no parent raises their child like in a vacuum. Culture and society are huge factors on how parents parent.
Now I have two thoughts. One, I guess I, until the last few weeks, several weeks actually, haven't been out and about much lately, but I've been on airplanes a lot. And so there are children on airplanes, and that seems to spark an opinion for everybody. And I am shocked by the rudeness of people telling parents how to do their job. So I'm apologizing to all of the parents out there who encounter rude people that are usually significantly older than them, but are kind of my age group at this moment. I'm just like, cool it, folks. Like last night, there was a crying baby on the plane and the people were upset about it. And sure, it's not fun, but there is a reason you all bring earplugs and have access to TV and music and things. You can kind of drown that out. But offering up the advice in kind of an accusatory way is it's not cool, man.
I have been that mom with that baby.
I have yet to see a mom or dad holding a screaming baby or toddler who doesn't want them to stop. It's like they do want them to stop. They're probably doing the very best that they can. And it occurred to me as I was watching that kind of unfold last night, and then hearing Ginger talk about, even those of us as professionals, do we think it or say it if the parents would just, and then we fill in the blank. Sometimes what the parent needs is not that at all, but for you to come alongside and ask them if you could help. Or for you to give them permission to. I mean, as a new mom, there were certain things that never occurred to me to do or to ask about in certain situations because maybe it hadn't been modeled for me or my family didn't do it that way. If you had a particular something that you could just, offer up as, could you try this? Or, it's totally okay to do this. I was really relieved when my mom, who would never have said this to me, I think before the children were born, said to me one day, if the baby is crying and just won't stop and you're feeling overwhelmed, it's okay to put the baby in the bassinet and walk out and get the mail. So she was giving me permission to take a break, right? It wouldn't have been okay for me to like walk a 5 mile walk or go to the mall and shop for an hour or that type of thing. But what she was saying to me is that sometimes, and she didn't even really know, she didn't have the words. Sometimes your nervous system needs to get reset. You need to be able to regulate yourself, all of those things to be able to come back in and deal. But sometimes we don't, not sometimes, all the time, we don't do a very good job of helping new parents understand what they need to know and what they need to do. And if they don't have community and their own parents and other people around them to show them those things, how do they know? I mean, instead of saying, well, if the parents would just maybe helping them understand what they might be able to do in a certain situation. Be helpful, especially if you already have a relationship with the parent in some way.
I love that. I love that so much. I just keep thinking too, like, I don't know that the baby's wanting to cry either. I don't understand, the lack of understanding of what's really
Well,
happening
and the
here.
baby, I mean, we just said it earlier, the baby is feeling an emotion and they don't really have any other way to express that
There's
emotion.
no other way.
And if the mom has gone through the basics, the hungry, the wet, the tired, I mean, what else has she got at that point?
Yeah, in an enclosed space or in any other moment, so good. One of my favorite statements from this chapter is that we as a society should protect time. Protect time for mothers and fathers to be affectionate to kids. We should advocate for policies that give longer and paid maternity and paternity leave. The science supports that. And perhaps just that step alone would produce lower adversities, lower ACE scores in the population. That's what Dr. Mate is telling us, that it is so worthy to protect this important early attachment window in a child's life. And it's just so sad that that precious time is so threatened in our today's society, where mothers still don't have easy access to time. What else does that baby need but time with that mother or that father? He uses this phrase, mothers still have to cobble together maternal leave time or place their child in the care of others at very early stages, whether they want to or not, right? Once we know better, we do better, but we do better needs to also apply to how we support
Yeah,
families. It's
exactly.
not just up to them, it's up to us as a society
Right.
to protect that
Yeah,
for
because
young
people need
children.
jobs. They have to have income. They can't get fired and lose their job just because they're trying to take care of their new child. All of those things. I mean, we
Yeah.
have to put the priority where it is.
And recognizing why. That's where we haven't really sat. And that's why I wanted to do this today, is recognizing the why behind why this is so important to talk about.
Dr. Gordon Neufeld teaches that children must feel an invitation to exist in our presence exactly the way they are. The child doesn't have to do anything or be anything different or win their love, right? Win the love of the parent. It doesn't depend on the child's behavior or their personality, that our love is just there, whether when the child shows up, they're showing up as good or bad, naughty or nice. I think that that's so very true. Now, here's the caveat. It's important that we clarify that this doesn't mean that parents or any of us are going to ignore dangerous behaviors or behaviors that are really outside of the norm, right? That need to be addressed. Loving a child does always mean guidance and it always means setting boundaries, but we also have to understand developmentally where that child is, right? We must do our best to monitor and curtail those actions from an unconditional love place, right? Where the child understands that nothing they do or say is going to threaten the overall relationship, even if we have to put a boundary on them or stop them from doing that behavior. And even if our nervous systems like flip our lids, right? That we start to get angry,
Right.
frustrated with them. That we handle those situations in ways that we reassure, make repair is really the language there, that the love is still in place, that nothing they're going to do is going to change that foundation for them. We can view misbehaviors as adaptations, as something that helped them survive the feelings that they're having, an unmet need that they have, or maybe a lagging skill that they haven't learned how to do yet and they're frustrated with. We often talk about getting curious and responding instead of reacting as parents, rather than punishing their behaviors or trying to stop the feelings that cause the behaviors. And we all try to do that. I know that those of you who are listening that are actively parenting little ones right now, you're like, okay, yeah, I'm trying to do that. It doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes, I flip my lid and all of those things. But the point here is that the goal is to show them that it doesn't matter what you do, your love for who you are. And we're born for love, we're wired to connect. But that doesn't always guarantee that we get everything we need. But yeah, the essence of what we need is security. And that's the point, is that we want them to grow up being secure, that love is always going to be there, not rejection, even while we are guiding and setting boundaries and correcting and then coming back and repairing if maybe we, you know, made them feel insecure about that, right? Because the goal is a safe relationship.
And you know what I feel like we learned from this chapter is that we know that infants bond with caregivers not only because they are dependent on them, right? Food, warmth, shelter. But here's where I really want to go is that social and emotional needs are just as much encoded in our neural circuitry for optimal development. And we have other needs besides food, warmth, shelter that must be met. That's where we're going next, is these irreducible needs that Dr. Mate points out. So Dr. Mate and Dr. Neufeld, I love his research as well. They teach us that if we don't meet the following four needs that we're going to dive into, they're really, it does impact us. There are consequences that cannot be ignored. So we need to focus on these irreducible needs in children. And so the very first one that we're going to talk about is a need for attachment, the attachment relationship, that children's deep sense of contact and connection comes from those who are responsible for them, and that that is a need that we have to have. So what matters is that child's sense of the attachment. It has nothing to do with whether or how much the parent loves the child or feels connected to the child. It's what the child senses, because we as adults tend to gauge our relationship in how we are feeling and what we are experiencing. But what makes the biggest difference is not what is sent to the child, what we give to the child, it's what the child actually receives, what they envelop. And so, you know, this takes mature and well-supported parents to be able to really attune into those child's emotional needs and really parse that out and have those differentiate and be distinct from their own.
Right.
And I know that's a lot to take in, but I don't want anyone to feel guilty, like, oh my gosh, I am not thinking about
I'm
this
not
all
doing
day.
It. Yeah, I'm messing up.
But this is just our jumping off point of thinking about how the child is receiving that
we want them
attachment.
To sense that attachment, and you don't have to get it right 100% of the time. You don't even have to get it right half of the time.
Amen.
The number is somewhere around a third of the time that you meet that child's need to feel connected. But what you've got to do is try to look at it from the child's perspective. And do you see that the child is feeling secure? And there are so many ways that this is hard for us, because we're trying to do other things. We're having to make an income and go to work. And then, unfortunately, sometimes our job is stressing us out, and we're having to think about that even as we pick our child up from the daycare that may or may not be high quality. Hopefully it is, and that they're getting good relational things going on there too. So we're distracted with the stress of what was happening at work. And then we have to come home and we have to make dinner. Or we may have had to stop at the grocery store, which is even worse, right? So just in that day, meanwhile, our phone is ringing and buzzing and texting, and other people in our sphere of influence are trying to communicate with us about a variety of things. So it's really hard for us to constantly be reading that child's reactions to us, because it's very easy to get distracted in other things, and the whole day goes by and you're going, what I was doing, you know, really make a difference? And where is my child emotionally? Like, did I take time to read them? And I'm not saying that so that you feel guilty about it. I'm just saying that it's true that we've got to figure out how to prioritize that, because a lot of times, unless our children are those crying infants, we can ignore a lot of things that we probably need to, you know, be able to pay more attention to. Or if we did pay attention to, we could know with a surety that they feel connected, or know that there was a problem there.
That is so, so good. So much to take in. I love that. Let's talk about the second irreducible need, and that is that the child needs a sense of attachment security that allows the child to rest and relax from the work of earning the right to be who they are as they are. So really, that's talking about authenticity, and that there's this drive to earn it. And so that true need, if we feel it, is this rest and relaxation, that it's just there. True security allows one to relax and rest. So this is just where that child isn't striving for attachment and working to maintain it. It's secure attachment. It's when we can reliably expect that our needs will be met, that emotionally, socially, intellectually, that growth is just going to follow. We're not even thinking about it. It's just there. Okay, so one of the most powerful stories that I really pulled from the book, and especially from this chapter, was Dr. Mate telling about when he was an infant, and that his mother was told by doctors how to sleep train and feed train him as an infant. So when he would cry, the doctors were trying to tell her that you don't have to feed the baby on demand. Just because the baby is crying and hungry doesn't mean that you should feed the baby. In fact, she used the term to him, that she wanted him to be a good baby so that he would eat when he was ready for him to do that, or sleep when it was time according to her calendar to do that. And basically, how that happened and how the doctors were training to do that was just by ignoring him, by ignoring any cues he gave, whether it was hunger or excuse me, crying. That's, that communication, to ignore that and just do that on her own schedule. But what he said regarding all of that was that in order to do that, she had to break his heart and break his hope so that he gave up. He quit crying because it didn't help. It didn't make a difference. His needs were not met by him communicating that way. So instead, what he did in order to handle the pain of hunger and other needs that he was trying to express is he just went numb. He, from a very, very early age, realized and learned not to disturb his parents. By him expressing himself, that was disturbing them, and that he needed to become a good baby. This is the story that his mother told him, and the reflection on that. And as he told that story, I had an experience of recalling myself as a brand new young mother of my son, Alec. And Alec would cry for hours after he was fed, after his diaper was changed, after what I understood as his needs were met, he still cried. He was autistic and I didn't know it. He was my very first baby, my very first experience. He made me a mother and I did not know a thing. So what did I do? I went to the doctor and I said, "Help this baby, something is wrong. He never stops crying. I cannot soothe him." And as a new mother, that's all I ever wanted to do was soothe this baby, rock this baby, hold this baby, love this baby. I had waited so long for this moment, and Alec would actually arch his back when I would hold him, and I just was
Both
at
of
my
you.
wit's end. It was so hard. So, what did the doctor tell me to do? To ignore him. So, I find it very interesting that Dr. Mate's mom, we're talking several generations, and still, the doctor was giving me the same advice. Ignore him. Eventually, he will stop crying. If you pick him up, you will spoil him. If every time that baby cries, you meet his needs, you will spoil him. That is the advice that the doctor gave to me. So I was extremely naive and I was on my own in a new town, and Rob was working 16-hour days because, his work situation. So I thought one night, okay, I'm going to try this. I am going to put him in the crib and I am just going to let him cry it out. That was, what the doctor said, let him cry it out. So I closed the door of his nursery and I sat down with my back against the door and sobbed like just as hard, just as long. It was the most painful cry that I heard from my baby and that I expressed myself. And I don't know how long it went on. I felt like it went on 10 hours. It could have only even been 10 minutes, but either way, I couldn't do it. I could not bear hearing that baby cry. And even though picking him up, sometimes it did soothe him and sometimes it didn't, I just could not give in to that, the doctor's advice. And I never told the doctor that. I never
Of
did
course you
tell them
didn't.
that because I knew that shame would follow. But it, boy, that whole talk from Dr. Mate in that chapter, I had actually kind of forgotten about it until that moment. And I just can see myself as a young mom sitting against that nursery, just needing help and not knowing what to do.
What I thought was interesting hearing your story is that he did in there talk about his mom's gut reaction. Her gut was telling her to go to him and meet his needs and all those things. But his poor mother, she was young. They were in not a very good society situation in terms of a war-torn situation. And she was bending to what she was told by doctors and the society around her. And developmentally, he was at least a year away from being able to realize anything cognitive, like go reason with babies, right? So what she was teaching him, what they were teaching him through this ignoring him, was that his needs were negotiable and that there was nothing unconditional about her relationship with him, right? That his worth was negotiable, that all of these things had a limit. So, like if you become too big of a burden on mom, then you're not as worthy. While Dr. Gabor Mate is plenty successful and has made plenty of real difference in the world, he still struggles today. And he points specifically to his own workaholic tendencies and his need to please tendencies that he believes are rooted in his inability to rest in who he was as a young child and just know that that was okay. So the scaffolding of this needing to be a good baby, needing to earn this attention and this security that has set him up for challenges.
Yeah. Don't you find it interesting too that like we hear that as even today, you'll hear someone say, "Oh, is he a good baby? Does he sleep through the night?" Like
As
we
if
equate
that's
it.
the
Yeah,
measurement.
that's the measurement. My goodness.
And as you were talking about this and telling the story about her sleep training and feed training, I'm cringing. And I don't know if all the listeners are cringing too, but I was thinking, oh man, that really, but that's advice that I received when I was a young mother. I'm just so happy that it's not the advice that my daughter and others are receiving.
Okay, well, let's dive into the next irreducible need, and that is the permission to feel one's emotion, all emotions, especially grief, anger, sadness, and pain. It's the need to be safe enough to remain vulnerable. I have studied this, I have read this, but I still feel inside me as I'm teaching this and talking to this how powerful this is. So, what he's saying is that in order for emotions to remain accessible, there must be an environment for the emotions to be safely expressed. If a child senses that their expression of feelings will threaten the relationship with their parents, if the parent is going to react in a certain way, then the child won't feel safe to express that. If what they're about to express is going to elicit a response that they don't want, then that creates, a feeling of unsafety in the child. So often we'll say to a child, stop crying, or why are you feeling that way? Or, Boys don't cry or toughen up. I mean, we've heard it said in a lot of different ways, but the message is stop. Don't feel that. Don't do that. Just stop.
Right. Don't
And
show this emotion.
exactly, right? And so what we need to understand here is saying that and doing that and giving that impression creates a feeling that you shouldn't express feelings, and that can create damage and can cause a wedge within the relationship. So
The
go ahead.
idea of sending them away for a time out, right? And
Yes.
say, you
Yes.
can come back and talk to me when you've calmed down. Well, we
Yeah.
all know that most of us don't march off to our room alone as children and calm down, because the way that we've been regulated is the closeness to our safe base, right? So that's like the opposite. And it's like, wait, whose nervous system is trying to get regulated
Yeah.
here? Not the
Yeah.
kids.
No, all those statements are definitely about the adult's needs, wanting everything to be okay, but it's sending the message that it's never okay to be angry. It's never okay to, be scared or vulnerable or
Or
really
express
any.
your pain or any of those kinds of things, right? During this section, when I was reading it, it reminded me of everything we learned in Circle of Security and the concept of shark music, and that the shark music that the parents are carrying, right, from their own childhood, because a lot of us were raised with, boys don't cry, or, I'll give you something to cry about, like all of those kinds of behaviors. So that's the tapes that we've got playing. And when our children do the same thing, then we hear that tape and we have to interrupt it. We have to interrupt that and realize that their big emotions are triggering our own emotions that we didn't get to express, right? And it's important that we don't squelch our baby's expressions and
Oh,
behavior.
yeah. Well, because the other message that gets sent is that your feelings don't matter, you don't matter. It puts conditions on the relationship, like we're only going to have fun, or I'm only going to love you if you act a certain way, right? And so, that leads me to talking about behavior modification, because we won't spend a ton of time here, but I just think it's important to point out that if you're using any form of behavior modification in the school, in the home, anywhere, it's a game that the child will always lose, and the relationship will always be harmed. There's so much anxiety for a child who is concerned about being rejected if their emotions start to surface and they are exhibiting a stress response and a behavior comes out. So it leaves a heavy toll on emotional health, on physical health. And in fact, Dr. Mate goes as far as to say that emotions have energy. And if we banish feelings and send those feelings underground, they will come back and haunt you and will
Yes, they
haunt us,
will. Well, and
for years.
Dr. Mate's work, a lot of his work is around addictions and around things that we do as adults that are harmful to ourselves. And so that's also what he's talking about, right?
That's
If you take
exactly what
that
he's talking
energy
about.
and you bury it as a child, as a young person, then it's going to come back. And rather than express that as an emotion, because you haven't really learned how to do that, you're going to take up another behavior to try to deal with whatever that energy is.
Yeah, he talks about that from that very early age, he was taught to just harden his heart, shield himself from any pain, and shield himself from grief. But what he discovered in doing that was that he also ended up shielding himself from joy. That you cannot, do one without the other. And so to this day, he says it's actually a struggle for him to discover joy. And that is so powerful.
No,
So
I had a lot of feelings about that too, because I was like,
yeah.
boy, it's hard to hold on to if you had a childhood that you were not supposed to express a lot of the negative side, because you
Right.
can't also express the positive.
No, if you avoid a certain feeling, you're going to avoid all
All
feelings.
feelings.
It's a big point. Okay, so here's where let's talk about the last irreducible need, and that is that children have an absolutely irreducible need to experience play, free play, and that it is needed in order for them to develop, thrive, grow, and mature. It's an irreducible need.
Right. And things like putting your baby on the floor and letting them play, assuming that you have a safe place to put them on the floor, is something that maybe you don't get told. But yeah, it's all about that, right? It's from the early clear up into the authentic play that allows them to use their imagination and be interactive and all of those things, right?
Right, it changes what it looks like, but it never that need never goes away. It's a child's work. And a lack of early play has been associated with ADHD, irritability, aggression. So if we want to foster a sense of being alive, right, and nurture, set up a nurturing world where children can experience this, then we have to play with them. And it can look like a lot of different things in a lot of different ways.
That's a challenge for some of us. I mean,
Yes,
and I say
exactly.
us because it was a challenge for me to be playful, to find the time and the energy to play with my children. But that is the way that they learn, and it is the way that they create and that they interact with the world around them. It's important. And when you don't let them do those things, like you said, all kinds of bad things happen to them. When you have a child who's come to you from significant trauma, their ability to play is usually impaired, or at least that's my
Yeah.
experience and the experience of many people that I have worked with throughout the years is that, and so that really even requires us or encourages us to get more playful
That's right.
with them, you know, to try to
Well,
find ways to engage them in play activities.
it shapes the developing brain and it can re help in the rewiring of a brain that has been impacted by adversity and trauma. And so, one of our favorite things that we like to teach, and we've talked about this in the past, so we don't need to spend too much time, but just to remind you about the PACE model by Dr. Dan Hughes, PACE, and that P is that very first tenet is play, all about keeping it light and bringing that. You cannot be angry and hurt at the same time that you're laughing and having fun. So that shift in the nervous system. And the A is about accepting and holding space. The C is about curiosity, which we've talked a lot about. And the E is empathy. If you want more information on the PACE model, go back and listen to our podcast where we have really diven. I can't think of the word.
Jumped
Dove
into the
deep.
middle of the PACE model.
Yeah, jumped into the middle of it because it is a powerful modality to use in the home and in the classroom. And this PACE model, in my opinion, is truly exemplified in these irreducible needs and in the intervention of where we go from here. I do think, you know, prevention is the key, but we all know, and that's why we talk a lot about early childhood and that important window. But you know, we all know that not every child has that safe, committed, attuned, resilience-building relationship. So that's why we also talk a lot about where we go from here and what therapeutic and trauma-sensitive things we can do in the schools and in our homes. You, as the parent, as the caregiver, as the coach, as the teacher, can be the strategy through the PACE model and through everything that we teach. And so hopefully talking about these irreducible needs and bringing them to the forefront of the importance of how healing and how essential they are to growth in our children. Hopefully that has struck a chord with you all today.
Yes,
Yes.
exactly. And made you interested in reading even more about the myth of normal and understand that many of the other parts that we're not going to podcast on have a lot to do with society and the ways that society needs to be changed. This book, in particular, by Dr. Amate and his son Daniel, is really focused on what we need to do as a society to shift the way that we're looking at this myth that everything we've been doing is normal when our neuroscience and our developmental science is telling us no, it isn't. If that's of interest to you, grab this book. It is long and so it'll take you a little while to read it, but you won't be sorry. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Next time, Ginger and Julie will continue to discuss Dr. Gabor Mate's book, The Myth of Normal, and have invited Ingrid Cochran to join them to talk about parenting in today's society. A special thanks to Lorraine Schneider, our editor, and Joe Kramer for donating our music. For more information about the Attachment and Trauma Network, visit our website at attachtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website and through anchor.fm. I'm Rebecca Drumsta. Thanks for listening.